live. I'm back with my program, and I'm Lina Mirmont. I have very interesting program today, especially because the uniqueness of my first guest. Her name is Deborah Mills. I will introduce her in a second, and I will certainly invite her to be part of this dialogue and my conversation with her. But I just wanted to let you know, all of you who is listening, that before I met this incredibly gifted person, I had a tremendous skepticism when I would hear about higher power, some spiritual or physical differences in the world of special gifts and special intuition and special vision. I was very open with my skepticism, and I have to say that after meeting with Ms. Deborah Mills, my skepticism not only greatly reduced, but I started to have profoundly deep respect for the ability which she has, and frankly, only very few people do have. She has this tremendous power of her intuition. She is able to connect her intuition with the physical world, with her tremendous world of wisdom, guidance, and literally helping people who are feeling so helpless and hopeless. Well, on this note, I'd like to introduce and to invite to our discussion Ms. Deborah Mills. Deborah, how are you?
I am doing really good today. It's a great day, and I've been a little rested this afternoon, so I'm in good shape.
Wow. Then I am just about to ask some tough questions.
Okay.
One of the confusion in today's very hectic and stressful world is how to keep your hope going and not to reach falsely for unexisting stars, and how to keep your spirit and your mental power as clear and as pure as possible. It looks that the world gets us in such challenging areas where either technology or our human aggression on times makes our spirit that much more challenged. And it's very, very hard sometimes to connect between our beauty of spirit to the reality of the world.
The thing that, you know, I try to teach all of my clients and people I come into contact with is that, you know, we can always, there's a negative and a positive to everything in the world. Even a car battery has a negative and a positive. And the thing is that we can take even negative situations, negative things in our life, and turn them into a positive. It's difficult to get through every day, especially the minute we step out our door or we turn on the television. We get a lot of negative input from the media, from just other people's energy. And yet, if we just continue to keep ourselves as balanced and centered, meditation, prayer, whatever your faith system is to keep your faith system going and to know that, and positive affirmations. There's not a morning that I don't get up that I don't at least give myself 10 positive affirmations every day about, you know, how great the day is going to be and how good I can make this day. We have the ability to take and make ourselves feel good. There are some monks in Tibet that they start their morning every morning by laughing, whether they feel like they're going to feel like laughing or not, and that starts their day off feeling very positive.
Well, I will be honest with you. I love to laugh. In fact, I feel that all of us still have that little silly child inside of us. And you just brought one point, and on a personal note, I have to share a little habit which I have with your tremendous help. Every morning, I look at email of the company you're working for, and I read a new thought and your points and your wisdom. And be honest with you, sometimes I'm fighting it. I would say, where in the world I can connect to this idealism, to this beautiful wisdom? Well, Deborah is so fortunate to have it, to experience this. But I'm not yet that big inside to relate to that. And in fact, the last one, or maybe a few days ago, you wrote one of those thoughts of one of the famous thinkers. And after this, your elaboration of the thought, and that happened to be Albert Schweitzer, who wrote that example is not the main thing in influence others. It is the only thing.
Exactly.
And, you know, the reason I pick him up, even though for years I have a fantastic collection of your sayings, and I'm so, so grateful, and I'm sure that thousands of your listeners and your clients, and I'm not taking it very lightly, because indeed you've been witnessing of thousands of souls and lives. I'm sure you are ready for so many books, if hopefully you will find the time for that. But continuing my thought, one of the reasons I did pick up on Albert Schweitzer is because the same writer happened to be one of the best writers of a biography of one of the greatest living composers, Johann Sebastian Bach. And Bach happened to be somewhat a guidance for the rest of the world of musical expression. Being a musician, I can relate to this in much easier way through music and that spirit. So I wanted to ask you, is there any room for compromise or any room for certain self-perfection when I feel that's where I want to be, but somehow, doing everything I can, I'm still not there?
Well, none of us are perfect. I mean, you know, all of us have our little faults and our little flaws. And my thing that I try to instill, even in myself, is this constant, okay, somebody is watching somewhere. I have people that walk up to me that I have no clue who they are, never met them or anything, and they'll walk up and they'll say, you know, I learned so much when you did this or that. And I didn't even know that they were around at the time that I was doing that. And that specific thing, here where I live, when I first opened my metaphysical shop, come to find out that it was against the law to do fortune telling in this city. And the churches all got up in a big uproar. And at first, you know, when I was younger, I did have a temper, and I was a little perturbed and a little upset. And then, you know, in thinking about putting myself in their place, I started working with the mayor's office just to change the law. Because, quite frankly, the people who did my nails were Buddhists. They weren't Christians either, and they were afraid that that they were going to be run out of town next because they weren't Christians. They were Buddhists, and the mayor's office let me know that because of the way I handled it with grace and dignity and and everything, you know, they changed the law here in this town because of the, that they saw that, you know, doing things in a graceful, positive way instead of, you know, reacting with anger, doubt, fear. And this is what I try to instill in everybody is before you do something, we have to think, we have to rethink it, write it down on paper, see how it looks to somebody else, and then edit it and then rethink it again. And this is a constant in my life that I try to do because I want to practice what I preach.
Deborah brings another question, a little confusion between being truthful and to have a self-control. I will perhaps pile my questions with a few other things, taking advantage of your tremendous gift and clarity of your spirit.
Mm-hmm.
We all have right to be upset, to explode, to certainly express our different emotions, but we certainly have to be so well aware if it is hurtful to someone who doesn't need to be hurt or being hurtful, just period, with no right to hurt anyone. At the same time, there is a respect for different feelings. Where is the difference in your vision in between being truthful to that very moment and maybe not terribly pleasant to the world, or to have self-control at any cost and be very well aware of each moment, what and how you're expressing?
That's the point is we all have our feelings and we should have our feelings, and because we don't want to walk around like a bunch of zombies. But the thing is there is, you know, it's that old saying, you get more flies with honey than you do with manure, you know. And the thing is people here that know me and my clients all know me, they know I'm going to tell them when they're off the track. You know, and I'm going to be blunt. And not here too long ago, this guy was supposed to be building a new bathroom in my house, and I just was very blunt. He didn't come when he was supposed to. He's taken money that he's not, that he's not done anything, and he took money and didn't do it. And I was very blunt with him. The thing is that yelling, screaming, cussing people out isn't going to get anywhere. It doesn't get the job done. And most people, you can actually see their eyes glaze over because they quit listening. And there's a way to be very firm and, you know, and take action when you need to be truthful with them about your feelings and how upset you are, and how to do it without, you know, literally cussing them out. You can express that you're hurt, that you're angry, but you gain more respect when we do it in a way that is more centered and balanced. Even to be quite honest, when I get really, really angry, I'm the one who's usually wore out and has to take a nap because I wore myself plumb out. I'm exhausted. I have a headache. I'm sick to my stomach. And so I found that the best thing to do is have those feelings and be truthful and say, I'm not happy with you. But there is a better way of doing it.
I have to confess that I remember one short dialogue I had with you. We had a little bit of a mismatch with the emails, and I wrote you and I said, I feel so bad that you might be upset because of this mismatch of an email. You sent me a short email back saying, I don't get upset anymore because it makes me tired.
Exactly. Exactly. I very seldom let myself get too upset about too much. And part of it is because if I find myself in a situation where I'm not happy, I confront it immediately so it doesn't build up in my mind and just keep building up worse and worse and worse. I'm very quick to say, hey, I'm not happy about this situation, rather than holding it in and letting it get bigger and bigger in my head. But truthfully, I mean, technology and stuff like that, if we got upset about that, we'd be upset every day. So that's something we just have to, either laugh about or cry about. And I prefer to laugh.
Well, there is, however, with all fairness, it's not that I need to give you any compliments of your accomplishments because it speaks for itself. But I think, with all fairness, it is a life experience. It is somewhat our personal standards and our, I would say, quality of mistakes we have. My mother used to say that don't get upset because if you don't have this, perhaps you will appreciate the next step that much more. Or to make it a little bit more transparent, you never know what you're missing until you have it, and then you can build your own appreciation or feelings of opposite, which brings the question of the process. And when you said to rethink, to rewrite, to reevaluate, I think it's a respect for the process, even if it takes 1 second. And we are so forced to have these quick results because we all have our own issues and fears. And, of course, with this economy, it brings such a terribly difficult financial stressful situations. So thinking and relaxing is not sometimes even part of our life. It's going as quickly as we can for what we need to get. So what you're describing is a process, and I think what you're teaching and what I learned from you is to have this constant feedback in between what you immediately understand, what is your immediate reaction, and then to take this spiritual breath and have that space around you and then speak to you, speak your mind, to be as honest as possible, even if it is painful. But this is already the process. And if you is in this process, then there is a way to learn, to way to polish and to make your mind is much closer to your soul. I don't know if you agree with what I just expressed.
I definitely agree with that. I feel like that... it is a process, and it's a behavior. It's a learned behavior. We as people we teach ourselves certain behaviors, and we can get ourselves, to go to the gym every day. We can get ourselves to, I know you play instruments. We can teach ourselves to practice our instrument every day. And this is the same thing. We can learn these behaviors of stopping and thinking before we react. And I'm 57 years old now, and I can tell you in my younger days, I didn't always do this. And, I found as I learned and taught myself to stop, think, and put myself in the other person's place that, we can change our behaviors, and in doing so, it changes the behaviors of people around us. It goes back to being an example and people learning by our example, rather than, you know, if we react with anger, they're going to react with anger back, and then it just turns into a big blow up. You know, if we react with kindness, then they're going to be stunned, sometimes stunned into silence. You know, they're just going to stop short and not know how to react because they were prepared for anger, and it makes a big difference.
Huge, huge difference, and you're absolutely correct. And, you know, only because time is limited, and perhaps if you will find another moment for the discussion, there are so many other thoughts and issues I wanted to discuss with you, but you brought something very, very sensitive, because the issue of expressing sadness, often people mixing this up with being weak. In fact, expressing sadness is most natural and very important feeling, and I believe that we have this chronic fear of expressing something which is troubling us. We have to go to the psychologist or psychiatrist, and we're whispering about this. Well, I know because of your experience and some of your colleagues, you have these tons of hours to hear about people's frustration, sadness, and situations in life, but not everyone has this privilege to speak with you. And I wanted to just to make a point that we have to start to recognize that weakness should be almost eradicated from our self-image, because we're only weak when we're hurting. We're only weak when we're committing a crime. But to express sadness and to share it, I think it's a tremendous strength, because we're honest and very noble about the way we feel.
Exactly. And we do have to, we can, you know, it's right to be, you know, we have the capacity to be sad. We have the capacity to be empathetic to other people's feelings, and we can cry. And there's a difference in that, because that is caring about other people as well as ourselves. And crying releases a lot of tension, a lot of stress. It also cleanses and clears a lot of things. And just as much as rain or anything else. So we have to allow ourselves these feelings. But when we are sad or feeling down or upset, it's not fair to take it out on people that have no part of the sadness. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. It's a huge difference. And again, it brings back to what you said, to think and to catch this moment of self-revaluation and see how you're expressing yourself. And I would add humbly one little thing. If you're very clear about what you said, about what you're upset about, then you more tend to state the fact, to describe the fact, and that will be that much less insulting or hurtful to the person. And this person will get much more clear message through the factual, even emotional factual description, rather through the direct attack in that another person.
Right, exactly, exactly.
Well, Deborah, I wanted to thank you so, so much. If we make this time warm for you, perhaps I will ask you again at some point when it's convenient for you, full understanding that your schedule is literally impossible. Deborah has around 50 to 60 clients a day. This is because of her gift, her tremendous power of spirituality, her humanity, which she was able to express just in that short half an hour of a program. So I will ask for you to consider to join us again, and only if you choose, if you like to give your website or information where people can find you, that would be fantastic, and I will give you this opportunity with saying goodbye.
Well, I thank you for having me on the show. My website is Moonzies, MOONZIES.com. If you Google Deborah Mills, you can find it. Thankfully, my son has a marketing company called First in Search, and he makes me first in the search engine. So you can find me. It's MOONZIES.com, and that's how you can find me.
And certainly we will, and I thank you so, so much. We will wish you a wonderful day with more of the wisdom. Wish you the best health. We'll need you, and until very soon. That was my very special guest, Deborah Mills, who has a power in human world, spiritual world, intellectual ideas. And I will take a little musical break before we will get into second program with another very interesting specialist in a human world.
Thank you.
Thank you. My second part of the program, I wanted to make sure that Dr. Soifer is online with us before I will introduce her, and I just wanted to make sure that our wonderful Don from BBS will connect us, and after which we will continue with a live with Dr. Soifers on the line. I guess we still have a little gap in between my guests. I will take an opportunity and we'll make an introduction of Dr. Soifer. Dr. Soifer, by any chance, are you there?
I'm Professor Merriman.
Well, welcome. I'm so glad that we did connect. I will make a short introduction. Dr. Soifer, probably one of the most prominent and gifted person in a child's world. I would say she's a giant for little people. Her research and then her practical knowledge goes way beyond her credentials, which I will mention in the course of the program. I like to make sure that Dr. Soifer will understand that we are very well aware of such incredibly sharp challenges which are confronted by young children in our very stressful modern world. And her particular work I found deeply resourceful, limitless, in understanding child psychology, child emotional world, and the fact that she is talking about language as a base learning experience and tool makes one believe that indeed she understands child language like very few can. Dr. Sofer, my first question is very general. What brought you to this child needs world, and what is the similarity between your own feeling of a child language and perhaps adult language?
Thank you for that wonderful general introduction.
I find them endlessly fascinating, and the gift that is particularly human is language, and observing, participating, and facilitating a youngster's growth in this gift called language to as a way of representing him or herself to the world, as a way of controlling the world, as a way of managing the world, as a way of demonstrating their creativity through play and imagination is not always available to every youngster. I love watching the process of language emerging, and I very much enjoy seeing the sense the children get when they are effective with language. So I've made my life's work the connection between the development of oral language and its relationship to literacy, the gift of being able to enjoy a good story in a book, made it my life's work to help those for whom those skills don't come perfectly naturally, because I see the effect of children of not being able to express themselves as fluently, as flavorfully, as easily with language in a world that is so quick and linguistically oriented. So it just intrigues me. There are so many ways to say the same thing, so many ways to express what you think, what you feel, to create, in some cases, a new world, or to explain the world in which you are when you have that that gift. And all children have to go to school. And though you may be a great dancer or a fabulous musician or a wonderful artist in school, you have to use language. And I want to feel that I've left the world a better place for having helped children get access to that gift.
You certainly established a beautiful tone to the program, stretching this idea of a language to a much more profound and much more resourceful way of self-expression. I need to be fair and to announce certain specific fields and accomplishments which took place in your life. You are a language pathologist, and in a second we will talk about specificity, how you approach in this field. For more than 30 years, you've been in clinical private university teaching, so you've been able actually to combine all the facets of learning which took place on the part of adults, relating this back to the children. You certainly had somehow time to being assistant clinical professor of pediatrics and faculty member in Early Intervention Training Institute. I also was quite taken with the fact that being in faculty of Albert Einstein College of Medicine, you had time to give lectures, and you also contributed to some important workshops which had to do with multisensory teaching of a basic language skills. So this is just to mention few of your accomplishments. I'd like to come back to language pathology. How do you visualize this particular channel of child's activity?
Well, I think as humans, we all, most of us, have this gift of language. We all talk. And this profession, speech and language pathology, covers all aspects of human communication. Indeed, I am originally trained to deal with all forms of communicative need, from those of very, very young children, all the way through adults, people who for one reason or another have lost their language capacity. Because I find children fascinating, I chose within my broad profession to specialize in regard to pediatrics. And that's where the Einstein piece becomes attached. And as well as the strong list of teaching activities, I love to teach. I spent the very first part of my career, many, many years of it, working one-to-one with a child. And then, of course, with the child's family as well. As a matter of fact, I'm still in touch with some of those now men and women who were once little boys and girls with whom I worked. But I found that if I taught other people the way I thought and why I thought that way and how I worked with the children, then I could reach more children that way. And then I realized if I taught that to teachers and also to pediatricians, and sometimes to psychologists and to psychiatrists and neurologists, I could reach even more children. So I began to differentiate and spend a lot more time teaching, because every teacher that I manage to reach goes back to her classroom with something new for all the boys and girls in her class. And so it was my goal to help children in as many ways as I could, to ultimately become effective adults, effective communicators, and effective socially and effective in literacy if we could get to them by reaching enough teachers. And so I've varied what I've done to teaching a lot of other people. You see it in children when they're frustrated, when they can't express themselves, and you see it in teenagers, and it's quite hard enough to be a teenager. And how it colors your personality development as well. So for me, language is the vehicle that drives the curriculum. It's the way we connect to others most commonly. And I want to make sure that children have language as a means of thinking and creating and feeling competent. So I teach a lot now to make sure that more and more children are reached.
In a minute, we will get to your center, which called Sofort Center for Children. I hope I pronounced that correctly, but the bottom line is that it is philosophy, and it's like a home for children.
It's a center for learning and child development. It is more of a place where people come with children to have their questions answered about how the youngster learns and how he thinks and how he feels, and then we work to facilitate that. There's many different disciplines that are represented here, but it is not a school, which is very different. It's very much how do we work with this particular child to figure out the best ways to teach him or her and provide them with enough skills to be independent.
And certainly, I will ask you to give a website for that because that's very critical information, and I like to get a little deeper on the approach, your philosophy, and your vision of your center. So could you kindly just let us know what is the website, how to find this center?
Thank you for that opportunity. It's the usual www.soifercenter.com. If one were to simply Google my name, it would direct you to the website where your listeners could see the array of things that we do that are designed to help children and their families. As I said, almost invariably on an individual basis.
I'd like to go into perhaps a little bit more of a spiritual intimate development of the child. And something reminded me my own experience, number of teaching, especially dealing with this famous verbalization of child's prodigy or a child with a special needs, and some gray area where indeed is a special needs or maybe it's a special talent. And as we spoke a little bit early before the program, I certainly felt very comfortable to discuss with you those very subtle, sometimes difficult to pinpoint areas, which happen to be very critical points of a child's development. And before I will ask you a question, I just wanted to give one example which still with me for so many years. I remember I discussed with a friend who is who used to be a psychiatrist, and he had a couple of children, and they both been gifted in their own rights. And I posed the question, what is the difference in a child's vision of certain objects? For one, it can be happy or sad. Another one can be somewhat invigorating, because child's imagination is so phenomenal. He gave me one example. He said, I had a child who came to my office, and when he saw a bowl with fruits, he said, oh, this is such a wonderful, tasty-looking fruit. Then the other child came, and he said, well, this is very interesting pear and couple of apples. So they both were right, of course, but the description was distinctly different. How did you find this approachable to discover where significant difference in child's perception takes place? How is your center is able to approach each individual child in a more of a subtle and yet very powerful perception of the world, which unfortunately a regular school just doesn't have any opportunity to see?
It's a very, very important and interesting question, because, as you say, it's very hard for schools to truly, genuinely see children as individuals. It's an enormous demand. There are 20 children in a class, 25 children in a class. There's a curriculum to be taught. The teacher comes from a certain perspective. And we're fully aware that in any year, the person who will influence your child's life the most can be his teacher. If you're not a good match child and teacher, you spend many hours a day in school. We have an advantage in that way. Because we work directly with the family, and because we see the children in one-to-one relationships, we have time and we have flexibility. Just this morning, we were talking about a little boy, a very, very, very bright little boy, who is ever so much an out-of-the-box thinker. He sees things in different ways than other children. And he can sometimes be disconcerting to his teachers, and he becomes very quickly hurt. His feelings are quickly wounded. So we talked this morning about how to put things into words so that he could remain available to hearing something new when he was being corrected. And we talked about the fact that he's very scientifically oriented. And because we work with him one-to-one, we can create sort of the scientific method with him. That he finds that very, very appealing. So we can lay out tasks and do it in a way that makes him comfortable. And when he will insist that things are a certain way, he's a boy that if you say to him, that's wrong, and it might well be quite wrong, he's crushed and can't go any further, or he becomes very silly and defensive. So instead, we change the language. We've already changed the format to adapt to his style, and slowly, slowly, when he feels safe and comfortable, we will fade some of those controls and give him a broader range. But we don't tell him what's wrong. We can say to him, do you know what? I disagree. And here's why I disagree. Now, how shall we think about that? So it's not a challenge or an assault to him as a thinker, because a lot of people don't fully get the way he thinks, but rather it becomes about us together, you and I. I understand how you think. This is how I think. How shall we deal with it together? Because even when he's wrong, he cannot tolerate that he's wrong, and it breaks him. He feels not only offended, but he feels inadequate, and then it's you don't want to do that. So we take very much into account who is this boy, who is this little girl, not only as a learner, but as a person, and how do we keep his little soul intact while we are helping him be the best he can be? So that's why I really liked that question, because we get to deal with the whole child. Yes, our focus is on language and thinking and literacy and learning, but there's a human being attached to that brain that has to learn all of those things. Forgive me for being so long-winded, but you really captured me with the question.
It's not long enough, I will say. I'm somewhat conscious of air time, and I do hope that perhaps at some point in the near future we will continue. But for remaining time, I'd like to proceed on this, because that shows tremendous, incredible, unique principle of which you combining personal and mental, emotional, and intellectual package in each child. Of course, it leads probably to another issue of examination of child's family. What is the history of the relationship inside of the family? It's just an endless situation where you have to incorporate and correlate all these qualities before you will find that very clear, unique approach to that individual child. I will add to that, again, we did talk about this a little bit prior to the program, that my personal experience just a little bit imposed with that, that concrete and abstract approach can find a wonderful union. And you brought one point which is very impressive, saying that this child is not alone. That's the whole purpose and environment of your center, where you get a child in an environment where he or she can handle any kind of a situation when our frustration becomes part of the process. So I believe that artistic approach can create that much more of a freedom of self-expression, not judgmental, and yet quite effective in expressing power of imagination. I guess my question is, how do you exercise these abstract imaginative points with developing of some concrete qualities, or even correcting some child's deficiency?
We try, because we're really looking at individual children. So many children come immediately to mind. I worked with a youngster many years ago, now a grown woman, who has over the years become my friend, who was a fabulous, talented, exceptional dancer. She could make her body move in ways that the music just flowed through her in movement. One of her dilemmas was that she has a very weak memory, and she could perform the dance moves much more effectively and more beautifully, frankly, than many of the others in her class, but she couldn't learn them as quickly. So it was always a source of frustration to her, because she knew what a good dancer she was, but the nature of her learning style was that she couldn't learn as quickly. So what we tried to do was play back and forth between the more abstract and creative and imaginative and the more concrete. We would use certain patterns of rhythm to facilitate her memory for schoolwork, because the memory affected her schoolwork as well. And sometimes by putting things that she had to memorize to music or to dance patterns, she could, by doing that in a multi-sensory way, it facilitated her memory for academic purposes. In other ways, we try and help the children by modeling first and teaching them how we do it, how to create images, techniques, strategies that will work for them, so that they have some ownership of what they've done. So we have one little boy who has great struggles with expressing himself verbally, and has reading struggles as well, but he is a very talented artist. So we have him create images that will help him access the words he wants, and he can visualize and then come up with more information than he can when he just is trying to say what he wants to say. So we use whatever techniques we can, because we're trying to function through a cognitive, linguistic, affective interaction that gets closer to the whole person. So it's an interesting, again, a dynamic question, abstract, imaginative points with the development of concrete skills. We do it all the time, because we get the privilege of working with them and figuring them out on a one-by-one basis.
Well, sometimes life is critically unfair. Right now I feel it because our time is really finished. However, the subject is so incredible. In the remaining seconds, I wanted to thank you so deeply. Your work is so rare in its talent, its intuition, its tremendous comprehension of child's world. It's greatly needed. I wanted to thank you so much personally, and from every parent and child I learn, and whatever will make you feel more inspired and more productive, I will be thanking you with all of us, families, children, and future adults.
Thank you so much for this opportunity. I really do appreciate it. The children are our future. It sounds so hackneyed, but it really matters. And how we build their foundations and how they feel about themselves gives us our next generation. And so thank you in return. I'm glad for the opportunity. And if anyone would like to has a specific question about their youngster, I'm more than happy to answer. Thanks again.
My mutual thanks until very, very soon. That was my second guest, very important to children's Dr. Sandra. And on this, I will say hi to one that was in a life. I'm Lina. Until next week.